Morning. All good? Good. You're going to need a big deep breath for today, guys. I'm not going to lie. Judges, wowee. What a book. I do want to say before I start today that one of the passages we'll be reading may not be suitable for younger ears. So particularly if you're online and you have little ones in the room, you may just want to keep your ear peaked for that bit. I just want you to be aware before we start. Judges is wild. It is wild. And I want to start by apologizing. We have not allocated enough time to this book. And that has been a mistake on our part, especially when we lost last week with a guest speaker. So we'll not make that mistake again around this. But what I want to do today then as a result, because we've only one more week before we move into our next series, is to do kind of like a back-end overview. So Jill at the start did like a front-end overview and helped us to prepare ourselves to think about the lens through which we can look at the book of Judges. I want to kind of do that from the end of the book. And I want to look back on the book and think about the main themes or the main ideas. And actually what I want to do today is bring us like five key lessons from this book of Judges as we look at it as an overview. Give me a wee wave if you are like the kind of person who loves the news. Give me a wee wave. No shame. Who has News 24 on all the time? You are my mother's people. She's like, we were raised on the news. It was like on all the time. I am the opposite of you. I cannot watch the news. I don't know whether it's I'm just too sensitive a wee soul for it. But amen. I watch the news and I'm like, this is awful. Like the bad news just keeps on coming and I cannot deal. So my attitude to life is ignorance is bliss. If the world's going on fire, I don't want to know about it because I've enough fire over here to deal with without all your fire too. I have to be really sensitive about the news because it really does stress me. And the thing is, when you watch the news all the time, you can start to kind of feel like, my life, the world's never been darker. You know, you can get that rhetoric in your head. It's just never been darker. But then you read the book of Judges and you think, well... I don't know if the world's never been darker, because it's just not true to say the world's never been darker. Read the book of Judges. There is, everything is kicking off in that book. There is family feuds, betrayal, you know, abuse, murder, civil war. It's like, it's child sacrifice. It's chaos. To say the world's never been darker is just simply not true. You read the book of Judges. Here's the thing about the book of Judges, it's our first lesson, and it's going to be completely unexpected, having said what I've just said. Lesson number one is this, hope is wisdom. Hope is wisdom. Sometimes if you're the kind of person who carries hope, you can be made to feel like you're a bit of an idiot. Like you don't know what's going on in the world. Oh, look at that plonker, they need a good dose of reality, all that hope. Well, I want to say that the facts lean in the direction of hope. Being a hope-filled person is not the absence of realism. It's not ignoring the facts. The facts lean in the direction of hope. Because here's the thing. You see, when you read the book of Judges from start to finish, as I did multiple times this week, and you sit in the despair of it, what you think is, oh, the story should end here. There's no coming back from this. How can it get this dark and there be anything after this in the story? There's no coming back from this. And yet you turn the page at the end of the book of Judges and a new book opens. And God's still present, and he's still speaking. And actually, after you read the book of Judges, you're going to see moments of miracles, revival, renewal, worship, holiness, and a savior on the way. Because hope is wisdom. This whole book teaches us that hope is wisdom. And we learn that right from the very, very start. When it says in Genesis, I know, don't roll your eyes. When it says in Genesis 1 verse 2, now the earth was formless and it was empty and darkness was over the surface of the deep. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. There's no coming back from this. But the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And he said, let there be light. And there was light. You see, from the very start of the story, we've been let in this idea that when darkness is over the surface of the deep, who is hovering? The Spirit of God, just waiting for a moment to say, let there be light, and there will be light. You know the thing about Judges? When you read the darkness of God's people in that book, I am not talking about the darkness of other people who didn't know the story of God. I am talking about the darkness of the people who did know the story of God. When you read the book of Judges and you see the darkness in the people who knew the story of God, you know what the reality is? The seed of the Messiah is tucked up in the deep darkness of the womb of Israel. The seed of the Messiah of salvation is not separate from, distinct from, over there in some shiny good place where everything's going well, tucked up in the deep darkness of this people. The deep moral darkness of this people, tucked up in that darkness, is the seed of the coming Messiah. Because where there is darkness, the Spirit of God is hovering. And hope becomes wisdom. And I want to start by saying to you today, if it's not just a global thing, maybe you feel like that kind of heavy global darkness, but maybe actually it's very personal for you. And you look at the stage and the phase of your life, and you look at what you've been through, and you look at what's now in your hands, and you say, there's no coming back from this. That circumstance that you look at, and you say, there's no coming back from this. I want you to remember Genesis 1:2. When darkness was over the surface of the deep, the Spirit of the Lord was hovering, and he said, let there be light, and there was light. And I want you to remember that when Judges closes and you think there's no coming back for this, 1 Samuel opens, and there he is, ready to redeem a nation. Because there's no such thing as hopelessness in the story of God. Hope is the wisdom of the story of God. It's important as the people of God that we remember that in a world that is hopeless in so many ways. The first lesson, and it's an unexpected one, isn't it, in the book of Judges? Hope is wisdom. That's going to be your wisdom. Your wisdom's going to be found in hope because God hasn't changed. And he still says, let there be light, and there is light. Hope is wisdom. I just want to pause here for a second as a side note. Before I got up and we were worshiping, I saw this picture of a pebble being dropped into the water. And you know when you drop a pebble in the water and you see the ripples? And I could see the ripples and they were going really, really wide. And at the same time, I heard this phrase in my mind, it's only a drop in the ocean. It's only a drop in the ocean. And I could feel the hopelessness of the person who had said that. And I don't know if that's something, there's someone in the room who said that this week about your impact in the situation in which you find yourself in. You're like, I know, but sure, it's only a drop in the ocean. Like, what difference is it going to make? It's only a drop in the ocean. And I feel like the Lord, if that's you, the Lord wants to remind you that it may only be a drop in the ocean, but you can't see the ripples. You can't see the ripples. Don't lose hope. You can't see the ripples of the one moment that you have with that person whose life seems to be on fire, and you're like, I can't fix this. You have no idea the impact of that one moment you've had with them in your workplace where you're like, this place, there's no hope. You're the hope. You're the pebble being dropped into the ocean. And it might only be a drop in the ocean, but you have no idea of the ripples. Hope is wisdom. That's what this book tells us. Hope is wisdom. That's lesson number one. However, I would say as you read the book of Judges, the other response that your heart may have as you read that is to get on your moral high horse. In gallops the high horse and you climb up on it. I climb up on it and go, well, did you ever? Would you ever look at those people, the things they did? And all of a sudden, you feel like you're gleaming because you're sitting beside the dirt of Judges, you know, and you climb up on your moral high horse, and I climb up on my moral high horse. How could that ever happen? And that's the question in your heart. How could that ever happen? How could these people do such things? How could that ever happen? Oh, be careful. Oh, be careful of that moral high horse. It will kick you when you least expect it. Because the second lesson in the book of Judges is this: folly is easy. Folly is easy. We may read this book and say, how could that ever happen? Folly is easy. Here's the thing. You see, when you read the book of Judges and you see people who've set their lives on fire, their nation on fire, social climates on fire, the thing is, no one sets out to wreck their own lives. No one sets out to put their family on fire, to burn up their life, to wreck their business, to ruin their friendships and their relationships and society at large. No one sets out to try and destroy their nation, or very few. No one sets out that way. Yet you look around and you will find people whose lives, marriages, homes, relationships, friendships, society as a whole is on fire everywhere. And yet no one wants to do that. So logically speaking, we have to realize, oh, folly must be easy. It must be really, really easy to slip into foolishness if nobody wants to set fire to their house, and yet here we are with houses on fire everywhere. You see, the thing is, usually things end up destroyed not because of a sudden fall, but because of a very slow, subtle decline. And it's so slow and so subtle you don't even notice it's happening, and that's the genius of that darkness, is that you don't even see it's happening. And sometimes there is a sudden fall, but even when there's a sudden fall, usually it has been preceded in the underworld of the person by a slow decline. Because nobody's trying to burn up their life, and yet there's lives on fire everywhere. Folly is so easy, and you've got to be careful. Actually, you're most at risk. I am most at risk when I think, oh, I would never. How could that ever happen? I would never. That's the most dangerous position any of us can be in. Because it says, remember in Genesis, whenever we have Cain, and God goes to Cain and he says this to Cain in Genesis 4, verse 7, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. And it desires to have you. But you must master it. It's crouching at your door and it desires to have you. And it looks like the neighborhood cat, but it is a lion waiting to devour. Do not welcome it into your life. Do not welcome it into your home. Oh, beware, sin is crouching at the door. And it doesn't just want to distract you. It wants to destroy you. And so the Lord comes to his people. He comes to Cain. He comes to you. He comes to me. And he says, oh, don't be so foolish to think that sin's not also crouching at your door. That it's at their door, but it's not at your door. Sin is crouching at the door and it seeks to devour you. Oh, be careful. You see, the right question is not, oh, how could that ever happen? Or that would never happen. It's not the right phrase. Oh, that would, how could they ever do that? It's not the right phrase. The right question is to ask, how did that happen? When you read the book of Judges, the response is not to say, oh, that would never happen to me. It's to ask the question, how did that happen? How do people who knew the Lord end up in such a state? How did it happen? Because you and I have to learn some lessons from this to make sure that we don't end up in the same devastation. How did it happen? You know how it happens? You see, when you read the book of Judges, you're going to see the same phrase over and over again. Let me read it to you from Judges 18, verse 1. In those days, Israel had no king. That's how it happens. It's important that Peter said what he said today. In those days, Israel had no king. And can I tell you, that's not saying what we think it is. It's not saying, oh, the reason that the people are in such disarray is because the structural hierarchy of the kingdom is off. You know, the reason this is not working is because they have no human king. The hierarchy and the structure's off. That's not what that's about. You know how I know that's not what that's about? Let me give you two reasons. One of the reasons is later on when you go into 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and they do have a king, guess what? They're no better. So it's not about a human king. And this is the other reason why I know that that's not what that phrase is about. Let me read to you from 1 Samuel, which is the next book after Judges. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel, it says, the people come to Samuel and they say this, you are old and your sons don't follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, as such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord and the Lord told him, listen to all the people are saying to you. It's not you they've rejected. They've rejected me as their king. Before there was ever a king put in place, the fact that there was a king put in place was a direct response and reality that they had rejected God as their king. So when it says in Judges that the reason that this decline is happening is because there was no king, it's not because they needed David, and it's not because they needed Solomon. It's because they had failed to bow the knee to the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. He was no longer their king. They had fully rejected his authority. And they were living under their own. How does it happen? That's how it happens. Folly's real easy when wisdom is silenced. Foolishness will start to feel like wisdom when you silence the voice of wisdom, when you begin to detach yourself from God's voice, all of a sudden, you'll be able to justify every foolish action. I'll be able to justify every foolish action I feel like doing. I'll be able to justify it all when I silence wisdom. Folly is easy. And that takes us to our third lesson, which is this: independence is death. I ended up down another one of my rabbit holes this week. Are you ready? And as I was reading the book of Judges over and over, I was like, I feel like anecdotally, I'm hearing God's name less the more I move through this book. Like the word God seems to be appearing less. And I thought to myself, I wonder, is that accurate or is that just, I'm just feeling that? So I'm a geek, guys. I can't help myself. You're just going to have to love me the way that I am. Geek, flower-loving, slug-hating person that I am, you're just going to have to embrace her. So I'm a geek. So I spent time looking at the original Hebrew, and I started to count, okay? I started to count the number of times that the word Jehovah, which is typically translated in our Bibles, the Lord, capital L, and Elohim, which can be translated from the Hebrew into gods, small g, or big G, God. But I only counted it the times that it referred to big G God, not the gods of the nations. I counted the number of times that we saw Jehovah, and I counted the number of times that we saw Elohim in each chapter. And then I made a wee graph. Do you want to see it? Yeah, come on. I know, I'm quite impressed with myself. This is what I do for fun, guys. So if you look at this graph, the blue is Jehovah. That's the number of times. Along the bottom is the chapters. Up the side is the number of times it's used. Blue is, now listen, this is me doing my best counting. I'm not a mathematician, so it mightn't be exactly accurate, but it's roughly there. Blue is the number of times Jehovah is used. Green is the number of times Elohim, as in referring to God, big G, capital G. And then the purple line is the sum total of the two. And what you'll notice is there's a steady decline. Even the peaks become less peaky as we go along. And the peaks are interesting. They're really interesting, those chapters, when you read them. And then as you get to the end, you'll start to see this massive low line, because God's name is being mentioned less and less and less and less. And it's no surprise that as you read through the book of Judges, it gets darker and darker and darker and darker, because God is being brought into the story less and less and less and less, and pushed to the wings more and more and more and more. You see, when you separate from life itself, guess what happens? Death. When as a nation, as a family, as an individual, we separate from life itself, death comes and decay follows. And so by the time you get to the end, you start to move through the book, like one of the last heroes, Samson, who's the best that they have to offer. Have you read Samson? Man's a lunatic. He's violent, he's petulant, he completely disrespects his parents, who happen to speak a little bit of wisdom. Who knew? Parents sometimes speak wisdom. Struggling parents, just roll with my... You know, he's violent. Everywhere he goes, there's wicked bodies. And he's the best that the nation has to offer. The peaks become less peaky. And it's steady decline. Because that's what happens when we separate ourselves from life itself. So let me draw your attention to a couple of different... Let's see the next graph. I've got two. Well, it's the same graph, but with a slight adaptation. So you see here, because I am a geek, I then thought, well, I wonder what the peak and the trough is. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it, to see what's happening when God's mentioned the most and when he's mentioned the least. So then I started to look at that. The peak here is Gideon. It's Gideon's story, which Richard so ably unpacked for us just a few weeks ago. You know the interesting thing about Gideon's story? Do you know why God's mentioned so much in Gideon's story? Because this man's perfect? No. Because he's better than the rest of us? No. Do you know why God's so prevalent in that chapter? Because this is a man in conversation. This is a man in conversation with the divine. By angels of the Lord, he's in conversation. He hasn't stopped talking to God. As he makes his decisions, as he charts his way forward, he's in constant communication with God. And I want to pause to remind us, if we've stopped talking to God, we are going to end up in a world of trouble. You've got to stay in conversation. Guys, listen, I'm long enough in the tooth to know sometimes that's hard. particularly if you're in pain. If you haven't developed the holy reflex of running to God with your pain, then it's very easy to turn away from him when you're in pain, or you're confused, or he's mysterious, or you don't understand the text, or insert the reason here. But we come out of conversation, we are done for. So even if your conversation with God is full of doubt, despair, anger, it doesn't matter. Stay in conversation. Keep talking to him. Even if the conversation is full of things you think, I can't say that to God. Yes, you can. What's the alternative? That you stop talking to life itself? Seems like a bad plan to me. When we come out of conversation with God, and here's the thing, it's subtle, because sometimes you can stay in conversation with God generally, but there's something you won't talk to him about. I'll talk to you about all these things, but I'm not talking to you about this. Dangerous. Because if you silence the voice of wisdom, folly will start to look like wisdom. If you push out the light, the darkness will no longer feel that dark. You've got to stay in conversation. And this is a beauty of Judges chapter 6. Is this not a perfect man? But this is a man who's staying in conversation with God. And as a result of staying in conversation with God, you know what happens? A whole nation is freed from oppression. A whole nation is freed from oppression because a person stayed in conversation. Oh, just a drop in the ocean. Your conversation with God means far more to the people around you than you realize. You've got to stay in conversation. That's what's happening in Judges 6. It sets it apart. Judges 19 is a very, very different story. Whenever you open Judges 19, and this is the part that's the passage that's maybe not suitable particularly for younger ears. I feel like it's not suitable for my ears, let's be honest. I don't watch anything above a PG. You know, like I'm struggling in Judges 19. It opens with these words, the same words we saw in Judges 18. In those days, Israel had no king. And you're like, oh, this is not going to go well. When the chapter opens that way, you're like, this is not going to go well. But then you're like, oh, no, wait. This is going to be fine. Because then the next sentence is, now a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim, we've got a Levite. Oh, guys, it's going to be fine. We've got a Levite. You know why I think it's going to be fine? Because this is what it says about the Levites in Numbers 1. Verse 53, in case you don't know who they are. The Levites are to be responsible for the care of the tabernacle of the covenant law. We've got someone here who's a tabernacle person. They're a law person. They're near the presence of God. They're responsible for looking after that house. We've got a Levite, guys. It's going to be fine. Nope. It's not going to be fine. Because we've got a Levite who should be close to the law, who should know what the presence of God would direct a person to do. And that's just not the story. And you know straight away, because it says, we've got this Levite, and this Levite has taken a concubine from Bethlehem. It's just like, we're already in trouble. We're already in trouble. This man's got a wife, but now he's taken a concubine, which is a female sex slave from Bethlehem. And this is a person who's supposed to represent God. So this lady runs back to her father's home and he goes to get her. This is Judges 19. He goes to get her. Dad tries to keep her in the house as long as he can. Bit of discussion, staying over a bit. And eventually the Levite's like, no, I'm going. And I'm taking her with me because we're in covenant now. And he sets out with this lady to make his way home to his own country. And they go to stop somewhere to stay over, but there's like he was like, we can't stop here because these people are not God's people. They're not the people of Israel, and we could be in danger and risk here because it's a very violent nation, remember? So we'll keep pressing on until we get to the people who are God's people, and then we'll be okay. So they press on, and they arrive in this area where the Benjamites, one of the tribes of Israel, live, and they think they're going to be okay, but you know they're not going to be okay because they're in the square. They're in the town square. And this man comes to them and says, you cannot sleep out here. Because he knows his location. It's like, this will not end well if you're out here at night. So this man brings them into his home. And this is what happens next. Judges 19. I'll jump down to verse, I think it says from verse 16, but I'll jump down from verse 22. While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house," that's the Levite who was visiting, "so that we can have sex with him." The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be vile. This man is my guest. Don't do this outrageous thing. Look, here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. I'll bring them out to you. And you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But as for this man, don't do this outrageous thing." But the man wouldn't listen. So the man took his concubine and he sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night. And at dawn they let her go. And at daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying and fell down at the door and lay there till daylight. When her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. Then the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. There's no answer because she's dead. It's horrific. It's horrific. And as you read on, what sparks next is, after the death of this beautiful woman, is a civil war. And stacks of people die. And these are the people of God. This hasn't happened suddenly. This has been a slow decline. Judges charts a couple of hundred years. It's been a slow decline. And we can get on our moral high horse. And I'm not saying we should not be appalled, because we ought to be. But we ought also to be cautioned with the reality that independence, separating ourselves from God, coming out of conversation with him, is the road to death. It's the road to death. We separate ourselves from life, death, and then decay. This is the story. You need to keep talking to him. I'm not trying to scare you. And I'm speaking to myself too. You need to stay in conversation with life and with wisdom. You begin to silence those voices. And the thing about the flesh is so subtle. As you see, when your flesh wants to do something that's bringing you into destruction, you know what your flesh will also want to do? Separate you from any godly wisdom that's around you. All of a sudden, you'll not want to be near those friends, because those friends challenge your choices. You'll not want to be in the church community, because the church community will challenge your choices. The flesh will try to take you as far away from wisdom as is possible so that your folly can have full run and will drive you to your own death. Oh, it's so subtle. Stay in conversation. Stay close to people who you know carry godly wisdom. Separation, independence is death. But I want us to look back at the graph. If you click onto the next slide, Aubrey, we have the graph again. I want to go back to this chapter 6, chapter 19, because I think that the story is about something we don't realize the story is about until we put these two chapters together. So if chapter 6 is a peak and chapter 19 is the trough, and you read those two chapters together, at first glance you'll think there is no connection here. Oh, but there is. There is a thread between these two chapters that shows me that what's gone wrong here may not be what you think has gone wrong at first glance. You see, it's really easy to read chapter 6 and think, oh, Gideon's the hero. And it's really easy to read chapter 19 and think, oh, the Benjamites are the villain. Now, don't get me wrong. Does Gideon have hero-like qualities? Absolutely. Are the Benjamites who do this horrendous act villainous? Absolutely. But I think there's something behind both of those things that you can miss if you don't put the two stories together. Because when you put the two stories together, in the English you miss it, but in the Hebrew there is an identical phrase that becomes the pivot point of both stories that takes the stories in two different directions. Gideon's story goes this way in chapter 6, and chapter 19, the story takes this massive decline. And it all pivots on the same phrase. Not obvious in the English. Let me show you it, though. The pivot point of the story in chapter 19 that we just read is this phrase. It says in chapter 19, verse 22, "While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house." See that phrase, men of the city, from the Hebrew word ish and ir? That phrase is really significant in the scriptural story. Judges is not the first time that turns up. You want to read the story of Lot and compare the story of Lot to the story here in Judges 19, you're going to see stacks of similar phrases. I mean, in the Hebrew, it's remarkable. In the English, it's still obvious, though. The comparison between those two things, and it's about the men of the city. So that phrase, men of the city, is a really important biblical phrase that often forms a pivot point or a turning point in the story. So the men of the city show up in Judges 19, and the pivot point happens when the men of the city show up. But actually, guess what happens in Judges 6, and you'll miss it because it may not be translated this way in your depending on your version of the Bible, it may not be translated this way. The men of the city show up in Judges 6 too, but it's handled very differently. The men of the city show up in Judges 19, they want the Levite sent out to them so that they can perpetrate all manner of violence. And they don't send the Levite out, but what they do send out is another vulnerable human being who is deserving of protection. But they're sent out to the men of the city as if they are valueless. So they're not protected from the men of the city, they're sent out. Judges chapter 6, the men of the city show up again. Let me show you what happens. So in Judges chapter 6, what's happened so far before we pick it up here is that God's been in this conversation with Gideon. He's asked Gideon to pull down the altar of Baal and the Asherah pole. Gideon has done that. That poses massive risk. Remember, this is a violent nation. And he's now pulling down people who they think are their gods who are protecting them. He's now pulling that down. So he's at risk. And I want you to see what happens next. In Judges chapter 6, verse 28, after he's done that, in the morning, in the NIV, it says the people of the town. But actually, in the Hebrew, it's the identical phrase from Judges 19, the men of the city, ish ir. In the morning, the men of the city got up. When the men of the city got up, there was Baal's altar demolished, with the Asherah pole beside it cut down and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. And they asked each other, who did this? And when they carefully investigated, they were told, Gideon, son of Joash, did it. The men of the city come to Joash. So now the men of the city have showed up at the door of the house. The men of the city demanded of Joash, bring out your son. Sound familiar? Bring out your son, he must die, because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name Jerubbaal that day, saying, let Baal contend with him. You know what Joash doesn't do? He doesn't send anybody out to the men of the city. Nobody. And that's the difference. That's the difference. When the men of the city come to the door of the house, what happens there is pivotal to the story. And so it can look like the story's about Gideon and the story's about the Benjamites, and yes, it partly is. But actually, preceding both of their actions, what Gideon will go on to do and what the Benjamites go on to do, there is a pivotal moment that happens at the door of the house, where the men of the city come and the person responsible for who is in the house makes a decision about what happens at the door of their house. And because of what happens at the door of their house, everything else, the story takes off in a direction from that point. And I want to give you lesson 4. Stewardship is everything. What happens at the door of your house matters. And it looks like a little bit of the story, but let me tell you, big doors swing on small hinges. What happens at the door of your house matters. You see, the people that you have been given stewardship over whether that is a friendship you're in and you have social stewardship in that space because it's a relational space, whether that's a business you run, employees you have, children that you care for, a husband, a wife, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, somebody that you have connection with, that means there's a measure of stewardship. Stewardship is everything, and what happens at the door of your house matters to the direction of the story. It matters more than we realize. What does it look like for us to stop being distracted by the big stories out there of demise and to ask ourselves a question about what am I sacrificing at the door of my house? What am I sacrificing at the door of my house? While I'm off building this business, have I left my children behind? While I'm off doing this thing, have I forgotten that I've got spiritual stewardship in this space and I've abdicated? Am I not being faithful with the thing that God has entrusted specifically to me? Stewardship matters. What happens at the door of your house matters. The whole story hangs in it, in fact. And the issue is, we think that those are the things that matter the least. But they're the things that matter the most. As we come to the end of this, I realize that this has not been easy listening, because Judges is not easy. But as we come to this, the end of this, I want you to give you the last lesson, and it's my favorite one of them all. And it's this. Number 5. God is better than you think he is. God is better than we 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 think he is. I love in scriptures it says, God doesn't even delight in the death of the wicked. Even when the wicked in these stories die, God's not like hip hip hooraying. God doesn't delight even in the death of the wicked. He's so slow to anger. He's rich in mercy. And he keeps showing up in the story, even though people misunderstand him. They abuse the power he's given them. They push him to the side. They reject him as king. He just keeps coming back and back and back and back and back, because he's better than we think he is. And here's the thing. You may have already blown up your life. You may have already done that. You may be sitting here or watching online feeling like, well, it's too late for me. The house is already on fire. But God is better than we think he is. And redemption is always possible in the story for those who will come back into conversation with God Most High. You know what I really, really love? I only noticed it this morning, actually. The Levite, it says of him that he was from the hill country of Ephraim. And he's a disaster in this story, that Levite. Hill country from Ephraim. Judges closes, a couple of chapters over, 1 Samuel opens, and it says, there was a man from the hill country of Ephraim. And you're like, oh no. But it's fine, because that man's Elkanah, his wife is Hannah, and together they're going to give birth to Samuel, and he's going to go right into the heart of the corruption of the temple and bring redemption. Because God is better than we think he is. And if we're still breathing, he's not done. And if we're still breathing, there's still hope for change. There's still hope for redemption. There's still hope. It takes us right back to the very first sentence. Hope is wisdom. Hope is wisdom. So as we bring this to a close, I have no desire to lighten this moment, because I don't think that that's what the Lord's asking me to do. Instead, as the team come and prepare, this is what I'm going to say. I reckon 3 things are happening in this room. Here are the 3 things I reckon that God is trying to do or offering, inviting us into in this room. Online, in Cafe Church. I think the first is this. I think it's a warning for all of us. Even if we're currently being faithful, you know, we're making good choices, we're doing all the right things, even there is a warning in Judges for all of us. Do not neglect the things that are good. Don't ever let them slip, not for a second, because there's lots of people in this book who start well and end terribly. So there is a warning for all of us to think about our conversation, Is God in all of our conversation? Is he invited into every decision that we are making, little and large? Is there an area of our life where we've stopped talking to God? There is a warning for all of us in this book, in the book of Judges. I think there's a warning for all of us. Second thing I think God is doing is this. I think this is an alarm bell moment for some. I think God is calling to you, to some of you today, who you're literally at the men of the city moment of your life. You're at the pivot point of your story, and you know it. Or maybe you've been blind to it, but right now the Lord wants to show you you're at the pivot point of your story, and the decision you make next to walk towards God or to do your own thing, the thing that you know God would not want you to do, that this decision matters. It really matters, and it's an alarm bell moment for some because the Lord is trying to prevent you from falling off the edge of a cliff that you are dangerously close to. To stop you from getting burned by the fire that you are currently playing with. And there is a call to repentance and to come back to him. Step away from the edge of the cliff. I think there's an alarm bell. And the thing about that is that's kindness. That's kindness. Because the Lord loves you. It's kindness when he comes, when you're at the edge of that cliff and says, don't do it. Kindness because you are beloved. It's because you are beloved. That's why he's there. And because your life matters. And because there's a future and a hope for you that he's trying to protect. Because you are beautiful and good and lovely. Because you're all of those things, God is standing at the edge of the cliff saying, don't do it. It's because you are beloved. There's an alarm bell. And the third thing I think God is doing is this. I think for those of you who feel like it's too late, God is saying, oh no, hope is wisdom. Oh, have you forgotten Genesis 1 verse 2? Darkness is hovering, but so is the Spirit of the Lord. Do not give up. Do not give up. There is redemption still to be had in this story. I can still turn this around, God is saying, if you will come back. And put your hand back in mine and come back into conversation about this. There may be a road ahead, a long road to restoration, but restoration is not beyond this story. It's not outside of your story. And so I'm going to invite you just to close your eyes for a moment, whether you're in Cafe Church, in the room, online even. And I'm going to give you a minute just to have a conversation quietly with God in your heart. I would invite you to invite the Holy Spirit to come and show you, because some of you may be very aware of what the Lord's doing right now, and others of you may be oblivious to what the Lord wants to do for you in this moment. So ask the Holy Spirit to come and to bring your mind to the place it needs to go. Holy Spirit.